You're listening to the Overdrive Podcast, Hour 1.
Just after 4 o'clock in Toronto, it's Overdrive. Gord Miller, Dave Poulin is back with us after the senior invitational at the Weston Golf Club.
Well, that was actually Monday. Yesterday was just...
Just a bunch of guys playing? How'd that go for you?
Better.
Oh, good.
Much better.
We were all concerned about that.
Much better, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
We have a lot to get to today. James Myrtle from The Athletic, our old pal, is going to join us at 4:30 to talk about his latest look at what the Leafs' depth chart will look like when the season starts, including how to make it all fit under the salary cap.
That'll be the challenge.
That'll be interesting.
High expectations for Ilya Mikheyev.
Yes. We're going to talk to Don Granato, assistant coach of the Buffalo Sabres, member of the legendary Granato clan, which means, of course, he is the brother-in-law to our Ray Ferraro.
It's quite a challenge when you inherit Ray Ferraro as a brother-in-law, but you really don't get much say in it.
Right. And Tony would, his brother Tony would tell you the same thing. Milt Stegall, TSN CFL Analyst.
CFL action.
A little CFL action coming up. What is going on with the Argos, and how can they fix it?
They're not very good.
See, that is why you are a highly regarded sports professional.
Sometimes
analysis like that.
Sometimes straight and plain and true is exactly what you're supposed to do, isn't it?
But I want to start today with a book. Now, bear with me. In the summer of 1977, my father took my friend Mickey Lalonde and me on a cross-country driving trip from Edmonton. We came here, visited my Aunt Betty, went to the Blue Jays in their first season. Then we went to Montreal, saw them in their first year at the Big O, visited my Aunt Ethel. And then we looked down to New York and saw my Uncle Charlie in New Jersey.
Pretty good trip right there.
Uncle Charlie loved and hated the New York Yankees. He cheered for them as a child. He had a picture of himself with Babe Ruth. He had an autographed Lou Gehrig baseball. He had an autographed Joe DiMaggio book. But he hated George Steinbrenner. He hated Billy Martin. And he hated Reggie
Jackson. He hated the new Yankees at that time.
But he took us to Yankee Stadium. And we walked around Monument Park. We watched the Yankees play. And we got back to his place in New Jersey. I was going to bed. And Uncle Charlie walked in and dropped a book on my nightstand and said, if you love baseball, read this book. It was written by Jim Boughton, who was a pretty good pitcher in his day. The Bulldog was a pretty hard-throwing pitcher. World Series hero for the Yankees in 64. But he's most famous for that book, Ball 4. And Jim Boughton passed away today at the age of 80. Ball 4 changed the way I looked at baseball, changed the way I look at sports, but I'm far from the only one. It's the greatest sports book ever written. It pulled back the curtain on the Yankees, on sports. Up until then, you know, athletes were milk-drinking choir boys.
It was the first inside look.
Right.
The real inside look. So not an article, not an interview. It was an inside look to a whole different level.
So we thought they were milk-drinking choir boys who pounded home runs and went home and kissed their kids goodnight. It turns out, after the game, they pounded 12 beers, took a cocktail waitress home, woke up at noon the next day, lined their stomach with buttermilk, and went right back at it because their family was living in Wichita, Kansas. And so, when it was published in 1970, Ball 4 was a sensation. But it was also deeply criticized within the baseball community.
It had to be.
Dick Young, the legendary New York writer, called Jim Boughton a leper. And a number of his teammates would have nothing to do with him. The book detailed the exploits of Mickey Mantle, his womanizing, his heavy drinking, his profanity, the way he treated kids who asked for his autograph, the way he viewed the media and teammates. And so for the longest time, Jim Boughton wasn't invited back to Old Timers Day. The Yankees would have nothing to do with him. It wasn't until the late 80s, his daughter died in a car accident, that George Steinbrenner, as a gesture of compassion, invited him back to Old Timers Day. And he was warmly welcomed. But Ball 4 changed everything in sports in terms of the way journalists covered sports, the way athletes talked about sports.
So how did it change the way journalists cover sports?
Because up until then, journalists had pretty much covered for the athletes. They traveled with them. They were their buddies. The stories of Mantle's drinking were sort of rumors, but reporters looked the other way. When Mantle would show up with both eyes in one socket, unable to speak, they'd look the other way. They covered for him. And then Ball 4 pulled the curtain back. And so fans didn't want to hear the sanitized, aren't these Greek gods, aren't they the greatest people of all time? They wanted the truth. And it took a long time for it to come out more and more. But Boughton changed the way we look at athletes and the way that readers looked at sports. When did you read it first?
It would have been mid-70s for me.
Yeah.
Early 70s, almost shortly after it came out. I used to read everything I'd get my hands on.
Right.
The day Instant Replay came out with Jerry Kramer, I read the book. Distant Replay with Jerry Kramer. Like, any kind of book like that, I just couldn't get enough of. I used to read Pro Football Guide 1970 from cover to cover. A little blurb on every player in the NFL.
Yep.
And so the Bowden book for me, you know, in my just starting into my teen years was shocking.
Right.
Absolutely shocking. And didn't know a lot of what I was even reading.
Right.
At that point. But through my playing career, the relationship I had with writers changed.
Sure.
And the group that we had originally in Philadelphia and the group we had in Boston, both, were much more pre-ball four like than post-ball four like, even in the early 80s.
Yeah, and that's still...
I think it was dependent on who you had as a beat writer.
Sure.
But we had Jay Greenberg, Al Morganti, you know, guys like that who were friends.
Right.
And then even in Boston, the Stephen Harris, who's left way too early, Kevin Paul DuPont, you know, veteran guys, and you trusted them, and they didn't... Al Morganti would walk in to a locker room, knapsack over his shoulder, no pen, no paper, and he'd stand there, and I'd say, "Are you going to take notes?" He goes, "I won't make you look bad. Don't worry. I know what you're... I know what a Dave Poulin quote looks like." Which was good and bad, right?
It's a joke that Red Fisher would be writing Mark Recchi's quotes in during the third period of a game because he knew what he was going to say.
He knew what he was going to say. But that trust and that relationship was there, even though, you know, as you say, in 1970 when that book came out, it shocked everybody. What's the closest thing? Like, there are books written by athletes since then, but not like that.
No. The books that would be in that vein would be A Season on the Brink, which was John Feinstein.
Brilliant. Bobby Knight.
Spent a year with Indiana and Bobby
Brilliant
Knight.
Brilliant book.
But that's not...
Yeah, that exposed Bobby Knight to a whole different
That exposed Bobby Knight as what he really was.
Yes.
A bully and a...
Yes.
The Jordan Rules, which is about Michael Jordan, the Chicago Bulls. The writer spent a year traveling with the Bulls, not writing game stories, but just observing them. But in terms of an athlete pulling the curtain back, we haven't really seen it.
I mean, not to that extent. So I read the Tiger book by Armand Gatien, and that went after him pretty well, but it wasn't an authorized... And
it doesn't have to be... I'm not saying it has to be a hit piece, but this was... What Ball 4 was an unvarnished view of what Major League Baseball was like. Farting contests in the outfield. And the part that gets lost in Ball 4 is that it's primarily the story of Bowden, who had a serious shoulder injury trying to get a knuckleball so he could stay in the big leagues, and the loss of confidence he had. And the fact that he didn't have confidence in his ability to pitch in the big leagues anymore. And you don't think of professional athletes as lacking confidence or having self-doubt. But he did, and that gets lost in all the salacious details about Mantle and Maris.
So what about The Game by Ken Dryden?
Well, that was, you know, The Game was...
Cerebral,
and it was an inside look at the Canadians' personalities. There wasn't a lot of, you know, you weren't hearing about...
No.
Guy Lafleur chain-smoking and...
No.
You know, that kind of thing. And I'm not saying that...
It was almost a philosophy book.
It was. I mean, you know, the books that have... I mean, you know, Richard Ben Kramer wrote a book about Joe DiMaggio, which is a much more, if you want to call it, complete look at DiMaggio, who was, you know, very distant, but also, you know, would only appear at public events if he was introduced as the greatest living ball player.
So what about the fiction border on reality, North Dallas Forty?
North Dallas Forty. So Peter Gent, former Dallas Cowboy, wrote North Dallas
Forty. Great writer.
Which is a terrific book about a fictitious NFL team in Dallas. Who could that be?
See Pierre LeBrun.
And you know, the great line from that book is, every time I say it's a business, you say it's a game. Every time I say it's a game, you say it's a business.
A great line.
The other part of Boughton's book is it pulls back the curtain on labor relations. Because there was no free agency then. And the reserve clause...
Just opening the door.
The reserve clause where baseball teams could keep your rights in perpetuity. They could just hold you forever.
Yeah, Curt Flood.
And do what they want. And then Curt Flood kicked the doors open in court to get free agent Marvin Miller. So So Boughton passed away today at 80. He had struggled with dementia for years.
No, but he came back into the fold.
He did. And he actually pitched, he came back and pitched like 5 years after he retired. But he did come back. He wrote a couple of sequels to Ball 4. He was a very sought-after speaker. Mm-hmm. And the Yankees did welcome him back. But for the longest time, he was not. He paid an awful price for writing that book. And I can see that. I mean, I'm sure you've been asked to write a book about the Flyers.
I have been asked to write a book. On a few different occasions. And I have written since 1990. And I was holed up, was 90 or 91? I was holed up in the Weston Bayshore after a surgery, and I had to stay in Vancouver for 2 weeks. So I bought a moleskin and started to write. And so I have now, literally close to 30 years of writing.
Mm-hmm.
But I would never write a book. I have everything. It's a lot of my thoughts, a lot of, through my retirement, through my coaching, through management, all the way through. I was approached at Notre Dame by Andrew Malcolm, Andrew wrote the Fury book.
Yep.
And Theo Fleury, and is a political writer, actually, Canadian. And he was the political writer for the LA Times. And he approached me about writing a book, and he wanted to do it like Feinstein did it with Bobby Knight. He wanted to spend a year with me as a coach. And I said, I will be different if you're there. He said, you'll forget I'm there. I said, I won't forget you're there. it's like 24/7.
Yeah.
Like when they traveled with us with the Leafs for ahead of the Winter Classic. And it was quite funny. The first meeting we sat in for that, the producer of that program was Bentley Wiener. Do you know Bentley?
Yeah.
And so there were 20 people around the table. And she opened up by showing John Tortorella in a meeting with all of the people post the year before and how lighthearted he was and how well it had gone and how he thanked them for the way they were. And she said, this is the way it's going to be. And so we had the trainers there, the coaches, and I was sort of the point person that from the Leafs. And so she said, we're just looking for the characters. We're looking for the stories. So I let her go, and then I said, so tell me who the best characters and stories were from the last couple of years. And as soon as I said it, she knew exactly where I was going. And she kind of froze up. And then she said, well, Ilya Briskolov was a good story. I said, okay, well, that cost the Flyers $50 million in a buyout, so we can't have that happening. She said, and I said, let me guess, Bruce Boudreau, that was a great story in Washington. He got fired. So each great story you're telling me about, someone's either getting fired or it's costing the team $50 million. So let's have a great story here without any of that happening because we all want to keep our jobs.
So Bruce Boudreau, I was talking to him afterwards, and he said, you got to remember every other word's the F word when he's telling the story, but they got me walking through a mall with ice cream on my shirt. There's Dan Bylsma and his family having dinner. He's wearing a jacket and the kids are wearing dresses. Like, who eats like that?
That's boring. They don't want that.
No.
So, but I can't imagine that I would just accept a writer being at my side for a full year and not be different. Now, Bobby Knight, clearly.
Bobby Knight kind of,
with Feinstein, he forgot he was there.
The other question is, how much do we want to know? How much do we want to know about these athletes?
Yeah. I don't know. I don't even tell stories.
Well, yeah, when you tell stories about the Flyers, they're, entertaining and they're not
absolutely
out of school.
I mean, I played for Mike Keenan for 4 years. How can I not have entertaining
stories? I traveled with the Oilers for 7 years in the 80s.
There you go.
So I've been asked to write,
Of course you have.
And what they want is, what was that like?
What they want, what happened. You're right. Not going to say it.
No.
You're going to say, well, Glenn Anderson did miss the flight back for game.
Yes.
Game five, yes. Right? You're going to say that.
It's a matter of public record.
Yeah, but you're not going to say why he missed the flight or how he missed the flight or some of the other shenanigans that were going on.
I think For me, I don't talk about players' personal lives on the air unless, A, they ask to, or, B, it directly affects their performance.
What's happening?
So if it, you know, if a player has to take time away from the rink and the reason is known. But when we hear a player like Tuukka Rask this year missed some time for personal reasons, it's none of our business.
No, first thought is that something bad has happened to the family. Right. That's your first thought.
Right, and so it's none of our business. And yet, there is, you know, a book like Ball 4 does take us behind the scenes and tell a story that is fascinating. So there is a funny sort of balance and a contradiction there in respecting players' privacy.
Still fully entertaining to this day.
Oh,
Ball 4.
Yeah.
It's tremendously entertaining. It's not outdated in any fashion.
In fact, it's probably funnier than ever.
It is. But, you know, right at the same time, that was Jerry Kramer writing the book, the right guard for the Green Bay Packers on those great teams. And I would say he made Vince Lombardi look rather tough and out of
what's the line from that? He treated us all the same, like dogs.
Like dogs. Yeah. And that's pretty expose for what, you know, the revered coach of the Green Bay Packers.
Well, Scotty Bowman has a book coming out this fall with Ken Dryden. And Dryden has spent 3 years talking to Scotty.
So Ken Dryden wrote the book about Scotty?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
And it's half about Scotty, and the other half is about the NHL's greatest dynasties, and almost like a playoff bracket, they play off against each other to get to the greatest dynasty of all time. Now, the story on Scotty Bowman is, you know, a lot of his players didn't like him.
What did Steve Schutt say about it?
Steve Schutt said, I hated him 364 days a year. And what happened the other day? I got my Stanley Cup ring. Bob Gainey. You know, I sat with Bob Gainey one night at the Madison Avenue pub here in Toronto for 12 hours. And the best thing I could get him to say about Scotty Bowman was that he made him a lot of money. The funny thing about that is that the guys that disliked Bowman the most, Jacques Lemaire, Bob Gainey, and Larry Robinson, all became exactly like him as coaches. Exacting, I mean,
interesting.
Taskmasters.
Detail.
Scotty was, if you went offside in practice, do the drill again. Don't go offside in practice. Don't do something in practice you wouldn't do in a game. And obsessed about travel times and practice times. And that's what Lemaire and Robinson and Gainey all did.
Well, it's funny because I coached for 10 years at the Division I level. I didn't like what I was turning into as a person, as a coach. I didn't like it. I didn't like waking up some morning to knowing I had to be an absolute terror in that locker room.
And say things to people
that you didn't want to say in order to get them to perform. The best line I ever heard about Scotty Bowman came from Ken Raggett, who was playing for him in Pittsburgh. And I asked him about him, and he laughed. He said, I've never seen guys get so upset when a guy they hate won't say hi to them in the morning.
Yeah.
Like, think about that. That's a brilliant way to put it. He said, you'd be walking down a hallway just with Scotty, and Scotty turned his head the other way. Yeah.
There's a story about a player when the Red Wings won the Cup in 2002. One of their players said, I'm the only guy that ever won the Stanley Cup, and it's the second best thing that happened to me that day, because Scotty retired after the game. But the funny thing is...
But is that necessary? Now, and I had the protege in Mike Keenan.
Yes.
Keenan had been under him for 3 years, had studied everything about him. So he was the head coach in Rochester.
Scotty was in Buffalo.
Keenan actually broke the contract in Rochester by coming back to the University of Toronto for a year, and Bob Clark hired him in his first move as general manager from the University of Toronto to be the head coach of the Philadelphia Flyers.
I think the thing about Scotty is that he changed with the times. When you had all the power... He treated the players badly. There's a famous story about Scotty. There was Murray Wilson in Montreal. He was a role player.
Third line guy.
Yeah, but he was well-liked by all the players. And he'd broken his leg late in the year and was ready to come back, but Scotty wasn't putting him in. And, you know, the captains came to Scotty. We need Murray Wilson. He needs his penalty killing. He needs his skating. Then in Red Fisher's column on the Sunday, it was, you know, the Canadians need Murray Wilson back in the lineup. So Scotty called the group in on Monday and said, the captains came to me and said, we need Murray Wilson. It's in the paper. So, oh, great. Murray, you're in. Who's out? No, I need a volunteer. We need Murray Wilson. Everyone, the captains say it. The paper says it. We need Murray Wilson. Who's coming out? I need a volunteer. Who's coming out? No one? how about I run the team? And he skated off.
And that is Keenan inside out and upside down.
Except that I don't know that Mike Keenan knew when to back off.
He did not.
And Scotty knew where the line was. Now, the line changed over the years. You know, he and Steve Yzerman had awful battles when Scotty first went to Detroit. Mm-hmm. I mean, Steve Yzerman was almost traded to the Colorado, or to the
Ottawa.
They were in Colorado at the time. Detroit was playing in Colorado, and a private jet went from Ottawa to pick him up. And at the last second, they backed out. When Steve's number was retired in Detroit, he made sure Scotty could be there.
Yeah, that's a long way.
Right? I mean, so
a long way.
So I think there is a difference between, but certainly, you know, a book about Scotty Bowman will have to touch on the fact that there were long stretches when players really didn't like him.
Well, you know what's interesting? If you look at two of the coaches in the NHL that are seen as most player-like coaches, two of them would be Rick Tocchet and Craig Berube.
Yeah.
And
John Cooper in Tampa.
Yeah, but I'm saying two of them.
Yeah, tough as
got their, you know, their coaching, a lot of it from Mike Keenan. And when we were at Tocchet's wedding, you know, I played in a foursome with Scotty Mellenby, Murray Craven, and Craig Berube. And each one of them begrudgingly admitted that he was the best coach they had. They hated him at the time. I don't think anyone disliked Mike Keenan more than Scott Mellenby. And he was going to break Scott Mellenby. And it was largely because Scott's dad was the executive producer of Hockey Night in Canada, yeah, and the Olympics and everything
and
else.
And Scott was a strong-willed guy.
And he was a strong-willed guy, but Mike saw him as soft. Can you imagine contemplating that Scott Mellenby had a soft bone in his body, let alone like how tough that kid was? And on a Saturday morning in Montreal, typical Monday or Saturday morning skate in Montreal back then might have had 1,000 people at it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in Toronto and Montreal, yeah, when you go into those skates, Philadelphia coming in, and he scratched Scott and then stayed out personally on the ice to skate him and skated him half boards over and back for like 45 minutes to the point of we had showered, changed, and were leaving, and it was still going on. And because we were, you know, there was just this big crowd there, Keenan was playing to them, and Scotty Mellenby said afterwards, I was going to fight him, but I was so tired, I thought I might lose.
Right? And you know, like, I mean, it's...
But years later, you know, in terms of getting out of that team what we had, we went to the Stanley Cup Finals twice in 3 years. We won the President's Cup, which didn't exist back then. We had 119 points 1 year in, you know, without three-point games. And we had one Hall of Famer on our team, Mark Howe. That's it.
You know, and I think Bowman got more out of great teams. Coaching great teams isn't always easy.
Oh, I think it's harder than coaching
Bowman
teams
more
on the
great,
rise.
Bowman got more out of great teams than anyone. But he battled with Mario Lemieux.
Mm-hmm.
There's a famous
story.
Think
of some of the guys he battled with.
The famous story about Lemieux was, you know, the great Badger Bob Johnson. They won the Cup in 91 in Pittsburgh. Then Badger Bob was diagnosed with brain cancer that summer. And so Scotty took over. He was a consultant. He became the head coach. First day of practice, training camp, Mario Lemieux comes on the ice, no helmet, no shoulder pads, just in a practice jersey, pants, shin pads, and his gloves. And Scotty went up to him and was like, you know, Mario, there's a lot of kids here. You know, we need to, you gotta wear your equipment. He goes, oh, you want me to put on some equipment? He goes, yeah, I'll be right back. So he goes out, goes to the dressing room, gets undressed, gets in his car, and drives home.
Here we go. On the way to two cups.
And later that season, the players mutinied on Scotty. They told Craig Patrick in Calgary, if he's on the ice for the morning skate, we're not playing the game that night.
And famously, the Rangers did on...
Right. And so Pierre Maguire and Rick Kehoe ran the practices for the rest of the year. Scotty was not on the ice for a game day skate the rest
Amazing.
Of the year. So all those stories, like all that... Now, will that come out in a book? I don't know. I mean...
Yeah, how deep will it go? And getting people to talk is, I mean, can I talk? Sure, I can talk. I mean, it doesn't behoove me to to do that. It just doesn't.
Right.
I mean, Dave Schultz got almost next to nothing to write a book or two. Right. And it really ostracized him for a long time with the Flyers.
Yeah.
A long time.
Right.
With that group of guys.
So there you go. So Jim Boughton... The age of 80 passes away.
Read the book.
Read the book. It'll change the way you look at athletes and sports. Still to come, we're going to talk to Don Granato, assistant coach of the Buffalo Sabres, a member of one of USA Hockey's royal families. We'll talk to Milt Stegall. And coming up next, James Mertl on with his latest look at what the Leafs will look like when the season starts this year. You're listening to Overdrive on TSN 1050, on the TSN app, and on TSN 4. The Stones. We didn't go see them in Oro Medente. Can you say that? Oro Medente? Up by Barry.
Apparently Eugene Melnick went to see them.
Yes, as did a minister of the crown. The Honorable Lisa McLeod and Eugene Melnick had quite a set to there.
Had a little jumping jack flash of their own.
Yes, it wasn't quite Altamont, but a little ride of their own. So the Leafs. You know, we've had nothing on the Marner front for over a week now. And so James Mertl in The Athletic has been putting together what he thinks the Leafs will look like once the season begins. And in his mind, in his point, he's got as many as 12 new players in the lineup. James Mertl, editor-in-chief of The Athletic, what do we call you?
That sounds fine, Cord. How are you doing?
Grand Poobah? Is there a hat? Like, is there a fur hat with the horns that you can wear? The Grand Poobah at The Athletic.
The good thing about working at a startup is the titles are fluid.
So. Yes, of course.
Well, I think before we start, you're well past startup at this point in terms of The Athletic. And yep. You guys are doing a terrific job. You know, in the position we're in, we want information all around the league and the quality of writers that are writing and the stories that are out there without limits to length or things like that. It's really, really a welcome addition to sports journalism.
Thank you. I appreciate the plug.
So, James, I think before we get into the depth chart, I think we need to address Marner. Because how he fits is going to be really important into what this team looks like, right?
Well, yeah, 100%. Yeah. I mean,
they've got 3.8 in cap space, roughly. Now, you can factor in up to $5.3 million in long-term injury relief for Nathan Horton. So that's $9 million.
Yeah, just take it out. Take Horton out of the whole thing.
So just if you ignore
just
Horton.
Just remove him.
Yeah, so basically, how do the Leafs fit Marner?
Around 10, they can fit him in just fine. I mean, they can carry a shorter roster than the 23-player max, right. And they did that a lot last year, too. So, you know, they can ride at 21 or 22 for most of the year, and that gets them to a point where you can fit $10 million in. Now, if Marner comes in at 10, 7, 5, 11, or higher than that, that's a real problem, and you're going to have to trade somebody else. I mean, there's no other way around it. You're going to have to move somebody else out. And if you look at this roster, there's not a lot of fat to cut off in terms of salary. There's not a lot of overpaid players on that roster. So that's part of the reason for the stalemate with Marner is they really can't afford to go higher than 10, I don't think, on whatever the contract's going to be.
If it was that number, wouldn't it be done now?
I mean, you can get into the conversation over what would a bridge deal look like and what would the number be on a bridge deal. And, you know, obviously that's going to be lower. I mean, the rumors are that the Leafs are willing to do 10 on a long-term deal, 7-8 years kind of thing. But they would want the number to be substantially lower if you're looking at a bridge deal. So, you know, those are different scenarios that fit more easily into the Leafs cap situation, and the Marner camp sounds like they want something closer to the Matthews contract.
What's your take on that? I mean, there is obviously wingers are different than centers, but he has led them in points the last 2 years. Patrick Kane is at least as valuable to Chicago as Jonathan Toews is.
And they knew that at the time because they gave them identical contracts.
So what's your take on you know, Marner coming in at 11 plus?
I don't think there's not a comparable around the league at wing with as few goals as Marner has scored in the first 3 years of his career that's making that kind of money. There just isn't. Like, you can't find, especially coming off an entry-level contract. Matthews is more, I would call him a unicorn in that, like, there's just not centers that produce the kind of goal production that he does. You know, maybe what you point to, like a Stamkos or a Malkin, or there just are very, very few players that do that. Whereas you can find more players that are comparable to what Marner's done on his entry-level deal in terms of not just point production, but goal production, how much of that point production has come from assists, And the other thing I think you got to be cognizant of with Marner is that his point production shot way up when he was with John Tavares. And I think that you can't understate that factor. Whereas a lot of the early part of his career, Matthews has been playing with Connor Brown, Zach Hyman, Kapanen last year at some point.
William Nylander?
A little bit, yeah. Not much last year. So I just think that the big year that Marner had was with John Tavares.
And I'd say the big year John Tavares had was with Mitch Marner. Those are primary assists.
That cuts both ways.
A lot of them are within 3 feet of the net. And, you know, if I'm making an argument for Marner, he's the guy with 94 points last year. And you talk about, you know, the bigger, stronger Matthews, the more durable player has been Mitch Marner.
Yeah, but I don't typically see guys penalized for missing games due to injury on second contracts, especially star players. Like Eichel didn't get penalized because he missed a lot of games off, you know, in his second season. So, you know, I don't see a comparable for Marner at 11 around the league. If you look, you know, I see one in his own locker room. But those are vastly different players, though. I mean, that's what we're talking about, and that's the evaluation that the Leafs front office has made. That they feel that Matthews is worth more than Marner, and that's why we're in the stalemate right now.
Right, and if you're representing Mitch Marner, you have a pretty good argument right now, James.
Except that part of that argument was predicated on getting an offer sheet from another team, and so far that hasn't shown up.
Right. Let's go through this roster. Let's start with the forwards. So you have 13 forwards, now not including Zach Hyman, who will start the year on long-term injury, but of the 13 forwards you have, five of them make less than $1 million a year. So let's start with the first line. Andreas Janssen, Austin Matthews, William Nylander.
Yeah, it looks pretty good to me. I mean, I like the way that Janssen played with Matthews last year, and I think getting Nylander, if Nylander's going to make almost $7 million on the cap, he's got to produce. And I think it's going to be hard for him to do that if he's not playing on one of the top two lines. So, and it feels like the chemistry that Marner has with Tavares, why would you break that up? So, ergo, Nylander plays with Matthews, and that makes the most sense. And I think a Janssen-Matthews-Nylander line, or whoever's on that left wing, is going to be very productive.
So now your second line, you've got the great first question mark, Ilya Mikheyev with John Tavares and Mitch Marner, assuming Marner's signed. Mikheyev's a gamble, right? As many players that come from Europe as free agents flush out as make it. But what makes you think that'll work there?
I just know that the Leafs are excited about him, and Babcock sounds excited about him, and I think he's going to get an opportunity. And that window there is open as long as Zach Hyman is out, because he was a hugely effective member of that line when he was healthy. So he's got the knee injury, he's got the knee surgery. No one knows when he's going to be back. Babcock said at the end of the year he thinks he's going to be able to beat the projection and get back early. If he takes the full 6 months, he's going to miss probably the first month of the season, and that opens a door for somebody to step in on that line and get an audition. And I think that it could be Janssen, it could be Mikheyev, it could be Trevor Moore. But whoever plays on that line is going to be frequently matched against top lines, because that's what they did a lot with Tavares and Marner last year. And it's going to have to be someone who's defensively responsible. And I think it'd be fascinating if they put the KHL import there and just see what he can do.
You know, it's interesting. I got a great scouting report on him. Very, very positive. Every aspect of the game. The person I got it from would be interested to see how the Leafs use him, because he's capable defense. But the one thing that stood out in the entire scouting report was they're going to have to be really patient with him. And that doesn't speak to playing him in the second line to start the year. And, you know, English is a factor with him. And now they really don't have anybody in the locker room to help mentor that aspect of it. And so that was the big fear, was the patience that they would have in the adjustment to the smaller rink, the NHL game, all those different factors. The skill side of it, the scoring side of it, the elite talent side of it, all there, just the question of the patience.
Yeah, that all makes sense to me. I mean, and I've been watching kind of his YouTube highlight videos, and he's a really interesting-looking player, but he's an interesting-looking player in the KHL. You know, I would worry about him. He's very good with the puck. You can tell from watching him, and his skating stride's a little bit odd, and I would be worried about the physicality of the NHL maybe potentially overwhelming him a little bit. The leagues are so different that, you know, we see highly touted KHL players come over all the time, and it just doesn't work out. And then every once in a while, there's a Panarin who comes in and completely can dominate the NHL. So you know, and some people have compared Mikheyev to Panarin, you know, as kind of like a lesser version. And he's good with the puck. So it'll be interesting. I think that makes a lot of sense that you're going to want to shelter him and break him in slowly. And I think that they're going to want to look at him in training camp. They're going to want to look at him in preseason and just see where they think he can fit in.
All right. So the third line, you've got Kerfoot, Kapanen, Trevor Moore. So Kerfoot moves into the Nazem Kadri spot.
Yeah, and I think that's where they intend to play him. I mean, they just gave him a 4-year contract for $3.5 million a year. He didn't play a ton of center for Colorado last year. I think he was probably there, you know, 20 or 30 games or something like that. And that's going to be a question mark, is if they feel like he can be a full-time center or not. But the question for me is, if Kerfoot's not your third line center, then who is? You know,
right.
is it Jason Spezza? There's not really are you going to put Nylander down there? And, you know, we already talked about it. It doesn't really make a lot of sense for a guy making $7 million to be playing so few minutes on your third line. So I think they're going to give Kerfoot a long look at that spot. He's fine on faceoffs. He's defensively responsible. He's not a big guy.
Lost your matchup then for that third line,
yep,
from a defensive,
yep,
standpoint. You know, with Trevor Moore on that side and Kerfoot in the middle, not necessarily a shutdown center by any means, you're going to be playing one of the top two lines essentially against the other team's best line, and then you've got Mikheyev in a defensive situation.
Yes. I think 100% that the top two, and I think that the minutes go up for the top two lines as well. I think you're going to see, just because you're not going to have the third line that you're going to want to play as much as you were comfortable playing Kadri. So, you know, the Leafs are going to be a little bit more top heavy. They're going to be breaking some guys in, like Trevor Moore's only played 25 regular season games in the NHL, and you know, it's going to be a question of how many minutes you want to give him. But you know, we're probably going to get to this next, but I think the fourth line is going to be capable of playing more minutes than what they had last year.
You've got Patan, Spezza, Shore, then Agostino in that mix. You know, so three guys making under $1 million. But I want to get quickly to the defense. You're intriguing with your defense group, because you've got Muzzin with Barry, who were, by the way, a pair at the World Championship in 2015. In Prague, and Mike Babcock watched them play every game there. Morgan Riley, Cody Ceci, Ben Harper, Justin Hall, and of course Travis Dermott on long-term IR. Why Muzzin and Barry together?
The debate with the Leafs D is, do you go Riley, Barry, and get your two best defensemen and your two puck movers playing together and kind of go all out, or do you look for some balance? And I think that balance makes the most sense, especially with, they're kind of trying to rehabilitate Cody Ceci a little bit. They think they can get more out of him than he showed in Ottawa by playing with a better partner than he had there and by playing less taxing minutes. So I think Cody Ceci doesn't get the tough matchups. You're going to want either one of Riley or Barry in that situation. And I think that if you just split it up and you give Ceci a really good partner against secondary competition, that's something that could work really well. But I would also expect that in-game situations, they're going to be mixing and matching those pairs, where if they need a goal, then it's Riley and Barry. And if they're ahead and they're trying to shut things down, then you got Muzzin out there with one of the right defensemen. And, you know, they've got some options here. And the blue line is going to be the thing that we're going to be talking about
right. All
year, with how different it is from what they had last year.
And why is Justin Hall an option now but wasn't last year?
I don't know what's going to happen with Justin Hall. I got to be honest with you. Like, I don't know what they intend to do with him. I mean, he's under contract. He didn't request a trade. So I don't know if they've told him you're going to get an opportunity or not. I mean, he only played 10 games last year. He was in the press box a lot. We saw him working out with the rolling mats and everything in the back of the arena a lot, because he just wasn't part of the team in a real sense. So either he gets an opportunity or they go with a more defensive-minded third pair. You know, I think when Dermott's out of the lineup, that third pair is not going to play that much, and they're going to really load the minutes on the top four. But, you know, maybe Marincin factors back in, because they signed him again to a one-way deal. Maybe Borgman gets another look. I don't see them bringing the kids in yet in Sandin and Liljegren. I just don't think they're ready.
James, we'll keep an eye on this, and the lines are always written in pencil, bound to change. Thanks for talking to us.
Okay, thanks, guys.
That's James Myrtle, the editor-in-chief of The Athletic, TO, with his look in July at what the Leafs' depth chart might look like.
Yeah, and we didn't get to dwell on the fourth line a little bit. I see that as a matchup issue. Nick Shore coming back from the KHL. Why, you know, how does that work? Nick Batan on the wing. And so there's a lot of questions without a doubt. And from a sandpaper standpoint, if that was the issue or an issue against the Bruins, you've lost Kadri, you've lost Connor Brown, you've lost Hainsey, who was sandpaper in front of the net, shorthanded. So you've lost at least three of your grittier players from the mix. There's a lot of questions, and particularly with the lower part of that lineup, because Alexander Kerfoot's not a matchup guy.
So let's talk about this when we come back, the grit versus skill debate and how to build a team. You're listening to Overdrive on TSN 1050, the TSN app, and watching on TSN 4. It's Overdrive on TSN 1050. Brian Hayes is on vacation for a couple of weeks. Been fun filling in for him. So just to pick up, we just talked to James Myrtle, editor-in-chief of The Athletic, a moment ago about what the Leafs' depth chart might look like. A couple of things that stand out. You have four players making 40% of the salaries. Depending what, I mean...
49%. 49% of the 81.5, depending on where Marner signs, that's having him sign at 10.
Right, that's 49%
will be absorbed by four forwards.
That's not a model that's been successful in the past.
Well, you go through, you immediately look at the best teams. And so you look at a Tampa Bay, and 35% is absorbed by their top forwards. Washington, 36.5%. Boston, 33%. Vegas, 35%. Mm-hmm. And that's with Stone at $9.5 million.
Right.
So St. Louis, 32%. And so the best team, San Jose, 32.7%. So the best teams are all in the mid-30s.
Yeah, no team's won the Cup with a $10 million player yet. Now, that'll change because the cap is inching up. But to your point, it's the percentage of the cap is the important number. That's for you, by the way, that pinging sound. I think your toast is ready.
I just turned it off. My toast is ready.
But I do wonder about that. I wonder more, though, about you and I were driving in Ottawa to a game. And I mentioned to you that the analyst community hates Mark Borowiecki.
Mm-hmm.
They hate him.
Mm-hmm.
They think he's hopeless. You said...
He brings an element.
That's going to be the debate with the Leafs.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is going to be Kyle Dubas's team. This is going to be... There aren't many holdovers pre-Dubas.
And another step this summer by who's gone from last year's team.
So do you think you can lose those grit players, those sandpaper players... And still be competitive.
I think it'll have to be addressed, Gord. I really do. I think it'll always be an element in the game. You have to have some of that grit and sandpaper.
So St. Louis would be an example of that. I mean, if you want to point to them, and it's dangerous to do this, but the most recent Stanley Cup champion, St. Louis.
I'm not talking about chasing what they're doing. I'm talking about having that always in your locker.
Right, because they have always. They have it in spades.
They have it in spades.
And so did Washington.
So did Boston.
So did Pittsburgh.
And you know, the teams, you look at Chicago, they had it on each of the Cup teams.
For sure they did.
Big time.
So, the LA Kings were
And I'm not talking about trying to repeat history, revisionist history, whatever. But you've lost, Connor Brown was a pretty gritty kid. And Kadri was a gritty kid that cost them.
Well, Kadri especially.
Yeah, and he cost them with his lack of discipline. So, you know, the other one, and we'll get to that at some point, San Jose's blowing it out on defense.
Right.
Blowing it out. 33% on 3D. And most teams are in the high teens. So they're taking the defensive side of what Toronto's doing. Now, those defensemen have won Norris's. You know, they've got heavy creds. But it's going to be interesting to see. The model's changing, no question. Question is, how much can it change?
When we come back, Joffrey Lupo on the Spittin' Chicklets podcast talked about his time in Toronto. We'll look at that when we return on Overdrive on TSN 1050, TSN.ca, the app, and on TSN 4.